relative to humans, we had to go back 280 million years ago to the dinosaurs. And with a brain the size of a shelled walnut, the reviewers were not very nice. They wrote me back basically asking me what I was smoking. But I continued, I decided to go ahead with the work, and I resubmitted the grant. And this time I was very lucky. I had somebody on the panel who was studying birdsong. And this person understood the striking parallels between the ontogeny of vocal communication in birds and humans. And for those of you unfamiliar with this, we know that, and we knew even in the 70s, that for both birds and humans, there was basically a sensitive phase. At that point, we called it a critical period. But it's a sensitive phase where exposure to the adult system allows development to proceed most readily. We, you and I can learn a second language as adults, but we're not going to sound as good. Okay, we're going to sound much better if we learn it during this sensitive phase. We know that both birds and humans engage in a babbling or a practice period where they experiment with the sounds that will ultimately become part of the repertoire. So just like little kids go around with ba ba ga ga da da, if you listen to juvenile birds and you try to listen to, say, a red-winged blackbird, whose normal song is like honkeree, you go in the marsh and you hear them go conk, 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 conk. It sounds really bizarre, okay? We also know that birds need to learn not just what to say, but the appropriate context in which to say it. So again, just like little kids who go around, they go, you know, what's that? And you go, that's a chair. And they go, what's that? And you go, table. And they go, what's that? And you go, no, 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 it's who's that? Because they're now pointing to Uncle Joe. Birds need to learn which songs to sing in territorial defense, which songs to sing for mate attraction. And we know, and again, even in the 1970s, we knew that in both birds and humans, there were particular chunks of the brain that were responsible for the learning, the storage, the memory, the production of vocal abilities. To fast forward a little bit, we now know that these are much more strong parallels between these vocal areas. We know that there are seven areas in both the human and the avian brain that are responsible for these things. We know a lot more of how they're connected and what's going on there. But this was, you know, even the 70s, we had some pretty good ideas about these types of information. The problem was, however, that despite all this information, we still had other data. And this was data from the 1950s or so, starting with Maurer, who tried to train a number of mimetic birds to engage in two-way communication with humans and failed miserably. And he used the standard psychological paradigms of the day, a stimulus response, where you give the stimulus to an animal, there's a black box there, you don't care what's going on, you wait for some kind of response. If it's the correct response, you give a piece of food to the animal, and the bird really likes this, or any animal that in this situation really likes it, because they've been starved down to 80% of their normal body weight. Now, I don't know, think about how you're feeling even now, and you all ran to the back to get a little bit of snack because you hadn't eaten in 3 hours. Imagine if you're 100 pounds and you're starved down to, you know, 80 pounds, and you get the feeling of what's going on here. And the bottom line was, the way Maurer did this, for an example, was he wanted the birds to learn to say hello when he walked into the room. And so the birds learn, they, you know, he walks into the room, they say hello, they get a piece of food. They think hello means give me food. They say it all the times during the day. It's not relevant. They're not rewarded. The behavior gets extinguished, and the bird, you know, really ended up not learning much of anything. Fast forward about a decade, Grosslight and Zahner decided they wanted to be more rigorous than Maurer. They locked a bunch of minor birds into sound isolation boxes. They played them tapes of human speech. The birds learned to reproduce the sounds of people opening and closing doors and turning on and off faucets, but nothing on the tapes. So at this point, the idea was that, and yet we knew that birds were, you know, heck, parrots were great mimics. So the idea was, okay, birds can mimic, but it's mindless mimicry, and they really don't know what they were saying. So when I began to be interested in this work, and I, having had a budgie myself that seemed to talk at least in a functionally relevant way, I started poking through the literature, and I found this paper by a German researcher, Dietmar Tod. Tod was an assistant professor in Otto Kurler's laboratory, and we're going to hear more about Kurler in a bit. But Tod developed this modeling technique, or a model rival technique, in which two humans demonstrated to the bird the types of behavior they wanted it to learn. So instead of a black box, you had a social information processor there. And the technique is incredibly simple. We adapted it quite a bit from Tod's work. But it's real simple. You have an object that the bird really wants, and you give the bird the label for that object so it can use that label to get what it really wants. Bird is on a perch and watching, and I show this object to a student and I say, what's this? The student labels it. For example, it's a key. And I give it to the key, it's a key. The student gets the object and starts scratching herself the way the bird would. The bird is falling off the perch because he's seeing weird sounds. It's mediated transfer of the object. We exchange roles of model, rival, and trainer. So the bird sees that one person is not always the model for the bird's behavior or the rival for the attention of the trainer, but that it's an interactive process. So the student shows it to me and says, what's this? And I go, and I get, nope, you're wrong. Bird sees not any weird noise, mediates transfer of the object. I get another chance, I say key. We go back and forth several times, then we show it to the bird. Bird's not going to say it right away because they have to work through the entire vocal tract, all the muscles involved, and all the parts of the vocal tract in order to say it. It's not easy. But they might say something like a whistly ee to begin with, and you can reward that and then work up from there. So using these techniques, we trained Alex to identify, over the 30 years that we worked together, about 50 different objects, labels for 7 colors, 6 shapes, 5 shapes, quantities up to, we'll hear today, about 8. He understood concepts of category. So you could show him a particular object and ask him, what color? Oh, blue. What shape? 4 corner. What matter? Wood. What toy? Block. He understood concepts of same and different. You show him 2 objects and ask him what's same or what's different. He would tell you the label of the category, color, shape, material, or none, if nothing were same or different. And this is very important, this concept of absence. He understood relative size, shown 2 objects. What color bigger, what color smaller, what matter bigger, what matter smaller, he could tell you that. And he spontaneously transferred the use of none to identify the situation where 2 objects were of the same size and there was no difference in size. He understood joint attention in the sense that when we did studies to try to teach him without attending joint attention, he didn't learn. Joint attention, very simply, when a child is learning speech, and this was work done by Dear Baldwin, Mike Tomasello, and others, the child, say, is sitting on the floor, and you're playing with the child, with the truck, and you're going back and forth, and you're talking about the truck, and the child's looking at you talking about the truck, the child learns how to say truck. If, however, you're standing with your back to the child and you're talking about the truck and the child is playing with the truck, the child has no reason to believe all that noise has anything to do with what the child is playing with and doesn't learn the label. And we did experiments with our birds to show that they too needed this joint attention for learning of these labels. Recursion, not in the sense, the linguistic sense that this is the cat that bit the rat, that ate the cheese, that lived in the house that Jack built, with all those recursive embedded phrases. But recursion in the sense that we could give him a tray full of stuff and ask him what object is green and 3 corners, or what color is 3 cornered and wood, or what shape is blue and metal. All right. So he would have to go back and keep in mind the original bit. We were asking about color, we were asking about shape or material, while he answered and found which things had the other 2 conjunctive properties. I talked about his ability to transfer information on the idea of none. Intentionality, he had phrases like, I want X and want to go Y, where X and Y were appropriate object or location labels. And these were intentional. If he asked for a grape and you gave him a banana, he would toss the banana back at you. And basically, what don't you understand? Want grape, excuse me. There was fast mapping of a sort in the sense that he would play with labels. And when he'd come up with something that we could map, we would map it to an object, and he would get that right away. So he learned the label gray by seeing himself in a mirror and asking what color. And from there, he started playing with the sound to grape, grain, chain, cane, and we could give him those objects, and they became immediately mapped. Just a little bit so you could hear him talking very simple things. Oh, wait a minute. This should be okay without that.
What
weight? What corn? Okay, so just a little bit of hearing him talk. The stuff we were working on, but just before he died, a lot on perception and cognition, numerical competence, which is the main focus of the talk today, and optical illusions. Literally, how did he see the world? And we did find he saw things like the Mueller-Lyer illusion exactly the same way we did. Also, creation of labels, that's a whole separate talk, but he was beginning to learn how to make new labels from the bits of sound, the phonemes of old labels. And this was phonological awareness, which is something that no other non-human was able to do. So numerical history, Otto Kuehler, mentioned him a little bit earlier. He was one of the first people to really study number concepts in animals in a very sophisticated manner, particularly birds. Okay, other people studied them in other animals. He was really working with birds. And this was a picture I was able to find of an old slide. So here, the way he worked the thing is he showed the bird, say there are four dots here, and then to be correct, the bird had to hit the correct four dots here. And you notice these are not the same orientation, they're not the same size, they're very different. And this is one of the old things. I couldn't find a picture of the more sophisticated study, but it was basically like this, where he had eight boxes around in a sort of a semicircle around the bird. Each box had a piece of paper on the lid, and each piece of paper had a different type of splots of paint that he changed for each trial. And the idea was that you could change the order of where the splots were, you would change the size of the splots so that sometimes one splot had more paint on it than five splots. I mean, he controlled for what we call mass and brightness and position and all the things you would possibly control for. So the animal could not respond to anything other than number. And then he would put like five blobs of clay next to the bird, and the bird would walk over to the box with the five dots and open that box for its reward. Kuehler called this thinking in unnamed numbers or non-numerical concepts, because obviously the bird wasn't going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but was doing some kind of very sophisticated match to sample with respect to number concepts. What was also very interesting was he did this with a number of different avian species. And chickens bottomed out at about 2 or 3, although if you look at some work by my Italian colleagues, you find that they can actually go up to about 4 or 5 if you do it appropriately. But on this particular task, they bottomed out at about 2 or 3. Pigeons, the standard, you know, bird used in all psychological tests to that time, came in at about 4 to 5. Gray parrots and jackdaws came in at 7 to 8. So this was, you know, a really interesting idea in terms of what these birds were doing. Also, what happened is at that time, people in the United States were looking at number concepts in humans. And one of the things that came out was the idea of subitizing, the idea of a quick perceptual mechanism for number recognition. Think about dots on dice or dominoes. You don't count. You know, you have a pattern recognition. It's called a canonical, is the fancy term, a canonical pattern recognition. So I can flash at you, you know, dominoes, and you'll go 12. And you just know it's 12 because you've learned that pattern. But if I flash things at you like that, and I ask you how many, you end up bottoming out at about the level of the pigeon at 4 to 5, because I'm not giving you time to count. And what you're doing is you can subitize, you can have a quick perceptual recognition up to about 4 to 5. And then you fall apart. You start getting much less accurate. 1, of course, is easy. 2 is easy. 3 is easy. 4, you're getting begin to get a little bit wiggly. So the idea was that, you know, they were trying to make some parallels between these animals who couldn't count the way we could count with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and the idea of this possible perceptual mechanism that was going on. So how were the parrots getting and the jackdaws going to 7 and 8? I mean, this was something that really nobody knew at this point. But again, the birds were not desperately time-limited the way the humans. There was considerable other work in Kuehler's lab with Lugler and also Braun, where they transferred the birds from this visual simultaneous to notes on a flute and flashes of light. So they would switch it to sequential and in the same mode of visual and then sequential in a different mode in terms of like notes on a flute. And the birds were still accurate to 7 to 8. Premet was doing work in the States. whole other story on teaching apes to communicate using plastic chips. Okay, each chip, like a green triangle would be banana and a blue square was apple or something like that. And he was trying to teach his ape Sarah on numbers, and he found that she did much better in doing match to sample with numbers than with labeling them with Arabic numbers. Okay? And Geshwin in the States also found that in humans, there were different parts of the brain responsible for match to sample versus labeling in general. So again, this starts making people wonder what was going on in these birds that they were able to do this kind of work. Well, I had a parrot who had all these vocal labels, okay? At the time, he had labels for a bunch of different objects, and he was learning shapes, and we had taught him three-corner for triangle, which is what triangle means, and then four-corner for square. And the question was, could we then transfer this to teach him to label stuff, numbers of different things? So we started with three and four because he had those labels. Now remember, this is very different from the way children do it. You don't start with three and four with kids, but that's what he had already speaking. So we could get the concept of number by working with three things and four things. Then we trained him on five things and two things, and then six things and one. And one was really hard because, you know, it's a key. And I tell him, what's here? Key. Why do I have to say one key? It's a key. Okay, it turned out that the single thing was really hard because I was trying to get him to do an additional label where he didn't see the point of it. So the data here is not with one, but it's only through two through six. And okay, it's a confusion matrix. You're going to say, really confusing, okay, but I can run it through you with you really quickly, and it's not that hard. In fact, it's a very succinct and clever way of showing material. So these are the objects presented to the bird. So it's pieces of paper, keys, wood, wooden plan sticks. Pegwood was our term for a clothespin, okay? In Britain, they're clothes pegs, and we use the term pegwood. And cork, which is sterilized corks that he loved to chew on. And then two, three, four, five, six of these objects. And this is the label he used. So, for example, if I gave him three pieces of paper, and he said three paper, he got a check mark in that box. And you can see he's right most of the time. He's correct. I mean, the diagonal responses are mostly correct. And overall, he was correct about 75-80% of the time. The U stands for unintelligible. Okay, if he says something like, meat wood, is it green or is it three? So those were errors. If a observer who didn't know what he was seeing couldn't tell you what the label was, that was an error. And you also see there are a lot of these errors. These are the generic errors. So this is when I would show him three objects, and I'd say, Alex, how many? And he'd say, key. And I go, well, I know there are keys. How many key? I'm asking you how many question. So it had to be counted as an error. Because if I'm asking him a how many question, and he's just telling the label for the objects, I can't count it as right. So essentially, those were a large proportion of the 20-25% errors that he made. You can see that these are, you know, quite a bit of those errors. I mean, sometimes he was off, but most of the time, here he's calling woods pegwoods and things. But you get the idea that most of the time he had these numbers down exactly. We could give him objects that at the time he couldn't label and just ask him how many. And they would be scattered as randomly as you can scatter small sets of objects. He was not time limited at this point, so whatever long it took him to do it, he could do it. We could give him trays like this and ask him how many key, how many cork, or how many toy. So he could separate that out. And this is very interesting because if you do this for small children at about, say, 3.5 years old, they have a terrible time of doing this. They always want to tell you the total number of things. Okay? And Alex was able to do this. So we took it one step further. I was at a conference and Trick and Polishin gave a talk, and they said if you give humans a tray equivalent to something like this, with red and blue wools and woods, and you say, you know, how many red wools, humans have to count something like this. They can't use a quick perceptual mechanism because pop-outs and things don't work because you're contrasting both the colors and the materials. And when you're doing that, the humans have to actually count. So the idea was, maybe this was one way of separating out Alex's abilities in terms of counting versus supertizing by giving him something like this and seeing how well he did. Well, he did very well. And he made some errors, but most of the time, 75-80% of the time there, he was right there. And if he were using some kind of perceptual mechanism, something like called Weber's Law would have kicked in, and he would have made the way you did when I blasted those things at you with the large numbers, would have made more errors on the larger numbers and more serious errors on the larger numbers. But he didn't. I mean, his errors were sort of randomly around there. He really did like to say four a lot, so that was something else. But again, you can see, there's no real errors that much over here. So we still didn't know if he was literally counting, because who knows, maybe parrots have better perceptual mechanisms than humans. In the wild, it's quite possible that numbers of repetitions of certain calls and things are very important. We know that's true for other birds. So maybe they have better perceptual mechanisms, we didn't know. But at least we could say that this bird was literally doing this task at a very high level of accuracy. And this is a little video of him doing the number test. And I need to tell you before I start, whenever we gave him a formal test, we would give him one of these trays that you'll see. And when he answered, he could ask for whatever reward he wanted. And then the tray went away. And then we would do not only a different tray, but a different task. We never clumped things. And so if he was asked a second question for the same tray, it was only if he had made a mistake. And so here I'm now going to be asking him multiple questions for a single tray, and you start seeing this behavior where the first one he answers right away. The second one I'm asking him, he sort of doesn't want to look at the tray, it's sort of confusing, he asks me. By the time I ask him the third question, he's really annoyed because this is not normal. And you'll see this change in behavior, which is what you sometimes get when you mass trials with animals that are very smart.
How many are you all? Very good boy. Okay, we'll get you that nut. There you go. Can you tell me how many orange block?
He's looking at me.
Very good. Six. Okay, last question. How many green block? Good boy. How many green block? Good boy. How many green block? Good boy.
Okay. So we had production. What about comprehension? Okay, and why is comprehension important? All right. Because maybe he really didn't truly understand the labels. And why do I say that? Because if you take a 3.5-year-old child and you give her a bunch of marbles and you say, how many? She'll go 1, 2, 3, 4. There are 4 marbles, and you think she understands 4. Then you give her a big bowl of marbles, and you say, give me 4. And at 3.5, she goes, takes a big handful, and she gives them to you. Because she doesn't really know how to count out 4. She doesn't truly understand 4. She has a memorized list, a number list, that means about the same thing as the alphabet at this point, where you think LMNOP is one letter, So it's 1, 2, 3, 4. And she has the things, and she can do a one-to-one correspondence and get the right answer, but there's no really, really strong understanding of what those numbers mean. And this is, again, at about 3.5 years old. Obviously, children go on beyond. So the question was, we had to test Alex's comprehension. What does he really understand? So we did a variation on the other task, and this is what I have to get. This is what we call the look. This is what you get when you give him these multiple questions per trial. And this was, for the comprehension task with this tray, it was very similar to the other things that we'd been doing for years. And the same old boring things, because the question was things like, what color 6? Or if we had things of the same color but different materials, or what toy blue, 6 or something. So they had to be the same old boring things he'd been working for with the last 15 years. And he went through the first 10 trials or so absolutely wonderfully well, and you'll see the data. And then he started balking. I'd bring up the tray, you'd get the look. He would sit there, he would take his beak and knock everything off the tray. He'd turn around and start preening. Or the best one was he'd look at a tray like this and I'd say, what color blue, you know, what color is six? And he'd say, orange, yellow, purple, gray, all the colors that were not on the tray. Which was, you know, a clear indication that it's not that I'm making a mistake. I'm giving you not things that are not even possible answers. So we started batting up against this. We started using jelly bellies, which aren't really healthy for birds, but, you know, to get them to work. I mean, we started, you know, playing game, anything we could to get the data. And obviously, we did. But this is to tell you what's coming. So these are the data, and they're really quite beautiful. We did this task. It was about 10 or 15 years after the original production task. So he had all those years of practice. He should be a lot better on this. I mean, it was really pretty much on target for all these labels when we finally, you know, got him all things. But what's this here with this none? Well, after about the first 10 or 12 trials or so, when he started acting up like this really horribly, I come in one day and I have a tray with 3, 4, and 6 things on the tray. And I ask him, what color 3? And he looks at me and he goes, 5. There are no 5 things on the tray. Alex, what color 3? 5. No, Alex, 3. What color 3? 5. And we go back and forth several times. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, there's no 5 things on the tray. He's not throwing everything on the floor. He's not turning his back on me and preening. He's not giving me all these wrong color answers. You know, something is going on here. So I finally look at him and I go, okay, smarty, you know, what color 5? And he looks at me and he goes, none. Now, you know, there's the first thing, which is a separate talk, on how he manipulated me into asking him the question he wanted to answer. But the, you know, the other part of this is that he had transferred his concept of absence of an attribute from same and different to the absence of stuff, which was a zero-like concept, which we as Westerners didn't have till the 1600s. So I kind of thought we had to go on, and we tested him on other aspects of this, and he was right on 5 out of 6 trials on other absences of things like this. So we didn't want to say it was zero. We called it a zero-like concept because we had to do a lot more to find out what was really going on. But this was an incredible breakthrough that he could transfer that kind of information across domains. We started... We were doing, okay, this was something we didn't plan to do, but we were working with the younger birds on sequential sounds. So the idea was, and we used a computer on this, so that there wasn't any kind of cueing and stuff, so that the numbers of clicks would vary and the inter-click intervals would vary, but the essential part of this was listen, how many? And we're asking Griffin, the younger bird, and he was doing this, you know, beak up, turning around, not paying attention. I'm going like, Griffin, come on. How many? Alex butts in and says 4. I tell him to be quiet. He butted into almost all of Griffin's sessions unmercifully, and I told him to be quiet because I clicked twice. And I go, Griffin, listen, how many? And Alex says 6. And at this point, I realize something's going on. And to do this on a sequential sound business, you can do it, but the cueing issues are really rough for addition and stuff. So instead, we decided to replicate the work of Boyson and Burnson, who had apes who walked around the room, and they'd open boxes and see how many apples, say, were in a box. And then when they opened 3 boxes, they then go to a number board and point to the total number of apples that they had found in the boxes. So we did this with Alex. We couldn't let him walk around the room, so there were these cups, and we hid things under the cups. He didn't know what was under the cups. And then you'll see the student lifting a cup, putting it down, lifting a cup, putting it down, and then asking him how many total. And the audio on this is really, really soft. But I want you to see the procedure.
Three.
Very soft 3. There's one nut on one under the other. So we did this for all sets of possible combinations. And again, he's pretty accurate. There were two points where he fell apart in interesting ways. So one was on five, and it doesn't show up here because these are first trial data, and only if he makes a mistake do we ask him the same question again in the same session. But he really had trouble with 5 plus 0. 3 plus 2 was not a problem. 4 plus 1 was not a problem. 5 plus 0, he had known 5 for years. I mean, for 15 years, he knew 5. And the student picks up 5 and puts it down, picks it up. There's nothing under there, puts it down, says, how many total? And Alex says 6 each time. And I'm kind of wondering, what is going on here? Trying to figure it out. And then I start realizing, wait a minute, this is the first time we have given him a time-limited session. Every other time, you put the tray out in front, and you just ask him until he answers. And if it takes 5 minutes, you know, you sit there twiddling your thumbs, and you just keep asking, and you get it. But here we gave him, like, you know, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. So we were about halfway through the trials, and we went back and now gave him, you know, 7 to 10 seconds. All of a sudden, it gets 5 plus 0. So this was our first indication that he was literally counting like humans because he needed time to do 5. Otherwise, it was just lots. And he said his biggest number, which was 6. Okay? Because he just saw lots very quickly, and he could do 4 plus 1 because he could quickly see the 4 and quickly see the 1 and add those up. And of course, for 6 plus 0, it was lots, so it was fine. And 5 plus 1 was also lots, so that was okay with 1. So we had gotten that time down. Now the none here, we put nothing under some cups, and we lifted up and show him there was nothing under the cups. And, you know, 5 times he just looked at us, wouldn't answer anything. Again, not the kind of behaviors that suggested, you know, boredom or anything like that. He didn't throw things on the floor, nothing. He just sort of looked. He never said 2, which was the number of cups. He just looked and looked at us as if, you know, something's missing here. Or 3 times he said 1, which was interesting because it suggested that he, like an ape that was also trained on 0, had some, and who made mistakes with confusing 1 and 0, that one was something to say that was at the low end of the number line. So that was suggesting he had some, as though he had somehow derived a number line and knew that this was at the low end. So this was something we needed to explore. But the idea with none was, you know, we were very interested in why he wasn't transferring none at this point. And we were realizing that in all cases, even if you think of that tray where there was an absence, it was an absence of the attribute of fiveness or something like that, which is different from the total absence of stuff. And I was asking him to comment on something that just didn't exist rather than the absence of an attribute. So we thought that he was, you know, at that point, we figured his zero-like concept was that of a very young child who was just beginning to get it. We were starting to train him on circles as none corner to see if that would transfer when he passed away, so we couldn't continue on that. We also were training him to identify Arabic numerals. And this was done by giving him a tray, like those trays, and we'd put all the refrigerator numbers on the tray of different colors. And the task was, you know, what color 6? Or what number blue? So we were training him on production. Okay, he knew the label 6 already, and he had already known that 6 blobs of something was 6, comprehension and production, and now we were training him for 6 and all the other ones on production and comprehension. So it was, you know, what color is 6 or what number is blue. So we had that. The question in our mind was, could he make this equivalence without training that the 6 and the blobs were the same thing? Okay, could he do that on his own? And we wanted to do that in a sort of an interesting way that we could do this many, many times. So we gave him a task of labeling the color of the bigger or the smaller numeral. So it's a little hard to see with the lights on, but there's a yellow 5 and a green 2. It's okay. It's this is the only slide that it's as important for. And the question was, what color number bigger or what color number smaller? So because it was a color response and not the numeral response, we could ask it multiple times with different sets of colors so that it wasn't just learning a pattern of when I see this, I say this, and when I see this, I say that. And so he was actually right quite a lot. And this time I was kind of nice about this. Sometimes he gave the numeral itself instead of the color. Even though I asked him what color number bigger, he could have heard number bigger. And so I ran this twice. So if you count the errors of his giving a number, if that counts as an error, he was still right, you know, 63 out of 84 times. And if you give him the credit for saying the number when I asked about the color, he was right 74. So he was really, really got this one down pat. Sometimes he said none erroneously, and we did give him, like, you know, two fours to see if he would say none. And most of the time he was correct and said none appropriately. There's an orange-yellow confound. These birds see in the ultraviolet. And usually in the lab, what we tried to do was have standard colors for the things, but now we were using those refrigerator numbers. And so some of the oranges weren't exactly standard, so sometimes he'd call them yellow instead of orange. And we never contrasted yellow and orange things because we knew this was a possibility. Twice he made the wrong choice. Once he said a color not on the tray, but he pretty much got this whole thing down pat. So this said that he had inferred the number line. And this is really important because, unlike children, he had not been taught the numbers in order. Okay? There was no distance effect. So the idea is, if I give you something like this and I give it to you, I would give it to you with a time limit, but it would be harder for you to tell me the difference between 3 and 4 versus 1 and 6, okay, because they're closer in a pattern. And we didn't give him time limits, so we did it by accuracy, and we saw no distance here. There's also a size effect. Okay, so 2 is twice as much as 1, but 5 and 6 are pretty close. And again, if I give you this task and I ask you which number bigger, and I give you a time limit, you're going to be more, have more trouble with 5 and 6 versus 1 versus 2. And again, he didn't have that kind of a issue. And again, for people are a lot better if the larger number is where you expect it to be on the number line, if I show it to you. And he didn't care about that. And again, you know, we just don't know, but sort of why would he? Okay. We also gave him things like this, and we'd say, what color number bigger, to see if he would be flummoxed by a physical sizeness. So the interesting thing was, the first half of the trials, first five trials, yes. You know, if you ask him something like that and you say, what color number bigger, he'd say, you know, yellow, okay? But it was about halfway through, it's like he started having all this, recognizing what we were really going for in all these other trials, and just switched over. Just totally switched over to saying none on trials like this. We couldn't do the opposition, which would have been really fun, like a small 4 and a big 2, because he passed away before we could do those trials. But those would have been pretty cool too. Okay, and he responded to number sets. I know I'm going to speak a little faster here. So if we gave him things like this, he was also correct. So he could understand that a single 6 was bigger than 3 things, unless we had it pitted against a single object. And then it was just, he went back to the numbers of objects. Okay, and he consistently said none. So he understood equivalence, he had understood the ordinality. Now apes, even these apes that had all this training on the number systems, they did not infer the ordinality of their numbers. They had to be trained. So even though Sally's chimps could go around and, you know, pick out 3 bananas and then point to the 3, when she tried to ask them which was bigger, the Arabic 3 or the Arabic 4, they couldn't do it. They had to be literally trained on that. And Alex had inferred this. So this was something that got us really interested in it, and the differences, again, between human and non-human abilities. Because I started working with Liz Spelke and Susan Carey on this when I was at the Radcliffe Institute. And, you know, children learn their first numbers slowly. So you take a child and it learns, it's about, I don't know, maybe a year old, year and a half old when it starts learning maybe 1, or 2 years old when it learns 1. And then it's 9 more months for it to learn 2. So they understand 1 and many, and 1, 2 and many. And then another 5 months for 1, 2, 3 and many. And then about the time they get 4, some children get it, some children don't. They put together with their rote number line that I talked about, it all of a sudden clicks. okay? And unlike, you know, animals, that most animals don't have that number line, the children integrate all the information. You never train a normal child on five. They get it. Once they get the 1, 2, 3, 4, they get the 5. 5 is one more than 4, and when you show them 5 things, it's one more than 4, and 6 is one more than 5, and it goes on from there. Okay? And this is what's called the successor function, and kids get it. You just don't, you know. So they get, apes do not. Again, they learn their first, just like children, they learn their first few numbers slowly, but there's no savings. If you look at Matsuzawa's work, you look at Sally's work, it was just as hard to teach 6 and 7 as it was to teach 1, 2, and 3. Now, Alex also learned his numbers slowly and also learned his larger numbers slowly, but he inferred the number line, and this suggested to us that maybe it was a vocal tract issue. Okay, for him to say a new number, again, he had to work through the trachea and the larynx, the syrinx, and the trachea and the glottis and the larynx and the beak opening and closing and the tongue going back and forth and up and down. All those muscles and things to learn this new label. So maybe that was part of it. How could we get around this? So we decided to train him on the Arabic 7 and 8, okay, separate from any numbers poking around, any blobs of stuff. And because he started saying 7 is 1, because that V is pretty hard without lips, we had to retrain him to say not just sit for 6, which is what he got away with, but sick, or s. So we couldn't cue him by waiting for the second syllable when he was going 1 versus 6. I mean, you get the idea. We had to be very careful about that. And again, at this point, he wouldn't even know that 7 and 8 were numbers because we were at the same time training him on phonemes. So he was being seen like an S is S and an SH is SH and things like that. So the idea was, you know, so it took about 13 months. He said 8 on the first trial because he had the label great. And he said 8 on the first trial. Okay? But for 7, it was months before we ended up with something like 7. And then we taught him, using the same idea with the numbers and colors, that 6 was less than 7 was less than 8, and 8 was greater than 7 was less than 6, so we'd put the two numbers on the tray and we'd model. What color number bigger, what color number smaller? So we taught him, now he knew that 7 and 8 were numbers and they were bigger than 6. But they could have meant 27 and 82. I mean, you know, it just, that was the pattern, okay. But we taught him that. Then we tested him on a whole number line to see if he could integrate all the information. And he did. Okay, so the idea was he's never trained on how 2 and 7 related to one another, but he did very well on this. Again, several errors on orange, several on giving us the number label instead of the color, but without those errors, he was really, really accurate. So he figured out where 7 and 8 fit on the number line, but again, he just knew, as far as we knew, he just knew that those were just bigger things. So the critical issue now was what happens the first time we give him 7 blobs of something and 8 blobs of something? Could he infer to how to use those labels? And again, we had never associated the Arabic labels with blobs of stuff. He did it. Okay. How did he do this? Okay, why didn't he think that it was just, you know, 7 meant 7 and didn't mean 72? We think it was because when we trained him, earlier, he learned 3 and 4, and then everything was either 1 less or 1 more. Each new number was 1 less or 1 more. And he knew none was less than 1, so you couldn't go in that sense. And we also told him that 7 and 8 were bigger than 6. So we think that's how he got it. But he did do it. And we could do things like show him 6 things and add 1, and he'd say 7, or we'd show him 8 things and take away 1, and he'd say 7. So we understood the successor function. He was much more like children than like apes in terms of this. Now, as I mentioned before, the last common ancestor, 280 million years ago. So what's going on here? Well, I think number concepts are very much a part of almost any individual creature that does foraging. And I'm not talking about exact numbers, but some sense of number, some sense of more versus less. Pretty much any animal that forages has to understand more versus less. You just can't survive without that. But when you give the apes and you give our the parrots the symbolic representation for a number, you're now giving them the appropriate tools to express whatever abilities are there. And I think this is relevant because you probably all have heard about the Priha tribes in Peru. They have, you know, labels for, it's not one, two, three, and many. It's labels for very, very, very few, some, and many. And they can't do number stuff at all. But I'm sure if you took any one of their children, dumped the child in Head Start, the child would do perfectly fine. I don't think it's anything genetic or any problematic issue. They don't need it. They're hunter-gatherers. They don't, you know, collect cows to trade them for wives or anything like that. They go hunting. They don't even need to count how many hunters. It's, you know, Joe, Sam, Bob, and me, and we're going to go on a hunting thing. So they have no number sense. Children who are home signers, who don't have, the paper just came out, who are home signers, who are not given exact number labels, are about the level of the Priha tribes. Okay, this is a paper that just came out. So the idea is this symbolic representation. And this is the last slide. These are gray parrots in Africa. And we did studies, and the summation thing is, okay, so you know, why are these birds so smart? Why do they have these abilities? It's the same answer that Allison Jolly and Nick Humphrey gave about why the apes are so smart. These are long-lived animals in complex social and ecological environments. They forage 60 kilometers a day, okay, and one of my students was out there watching them. He's here today. It was very hard to mark them, as you can see. You wouldn't be able to see leg bands. So we don't know much about their individual systems. In the lab, there's a dominance hierarchy. We think there probably were dominance hierarchies out there, but we don't know. But the point is, when you've got this animal's complex ecological environment and long-lived, you've got to remember where everything is over 60 kilometers a day and what over your lifetime is no longer any good and what is becoming good and things like that. You've got to keep all that stuff and update it all the time. In dominance hierarchies, you know, if Joe beat up on Sam and Sam beat up on me, you don't even go near Joe because you don't need to be beaten to a pulp. That's a transitive inference. It's a very complex thing to understand that without experiencing it. The parents probably have something like that too. So the idea is these, and again, that dominance hierarchy can change over time because Joe will die off at some point. And you know what? Sam may not inherit. Billy and Bobby may join a coalition and take over too. So you have to update all this information and get it all the time. We also think that part of what may be going on that makes the parrots a little bit better than the apes in this is their vocal learning abilities. Maybe it's the idea of needing to learn vocalizations that have particular patterns and ordinalities in a sense of what comes first or last in their vocalizations. Might have something to do that helps them with this too that we don't know, but that's just a sort of a theory. So I kind of want to leave you with the idea that, you know, an animal does not have to look like us. It does not have to have a physically large brain, although we do know that it has to have a relatively large cortical area for that brain, which is what people have found, and that they can do these incredible things that we are not aware of unless we sit and really pay attention and really design the experiments to do so. Thank you.